And so we turn to Proverbs chapter 6. Last week with chapter 5, we entered into a kind of middle section in these first nine chapters, chapters 5, 6, and 7, in which the father warns the sons against the strange woman, but that's all sort of laid to the side during the first 23 verses of chapter 6. Chapter 6 takes us through a sort of potpourri of other topics, unrelated topics. So we have about four or five different things to think about this morning. Let's take the first five verses. My son, says the sage, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given your pledge, or literally it says, have clapped your hand with a stranger, that clapping of hand being probably a kind of signal of a contract that's made between two parties. If you are snared in the utterance of your lips, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself, for you have come into your neighbor's power. Go hasten and importune or storm your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hunter and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. So here we have an exhortation, a warning against becoming surety for someone whom you don't know. We don't know very much about how this custom worked in antiquity. Surety is a word that we don't use much in modern English, at least not in this sense. In this sense, I think I've only ever encountered the word in the Bible. It's one of those sort of antiquated terms that persists in Bible translations. Although it is probably related to our modern word insurance, it's a similar idea to insurance, because it has to do with one person assuming the liabilities or the obligations of somebody else. Now, there's only really one major passage in the Bible that even gives us a glimpse into how this might have worked in its day. We'd have to go back to Genesis chapter 43. A passage that we just went through not so many weeks ago. In connection with another study. There's a famine in the land of Palestine. Jacob is the father and he has the 12 sons. Well, the 11 sons that he knows about. Joseph appears to have disappeared from the scene. And so he tells the sons that remain to go back to Egypt for the second time and get some more grain. And the sons object because Joseph has told them he won't see them unless they bring Benjamin with them. And in Genesis 43, verse 8, Judah was the spokesperson for the other brothers here. Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me. In other words, send Benjamin in my care. And we will arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be surety for him. Of my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. For if we had not delayed, we would now have returned twice. So in that context, Judah is sort of taking complete responsibility for Benjamin. Whatever Whatever might happen to Benjamin, Judah will assume the obligation of settling everything. And in fact, it works out like this. Further down in the narrative, in the next chapter, Genesis 44, after they get there in Egypt, sure enough, Joseph, who has not yet revealed himself to his brothers, they just perceive him to be the ruler down there in Egypt. He puts his cup in Benjamin's sack, so that he can keep Benjamin behind and send the brothers back home with the grain. Verse 17 of chapter 44, Joseph says, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, Lot, the other 10 of you, go up in peace to your father." Then Judah once again is the spokesperson. He steps forward and he spills out the whole story. And down in verse 32, he says, "Your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now, therefore, let your servant, I pray you, remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go back with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the lad is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would come upon my father.'" So, in effect, Judah is saying, imprison me or take me as your slave instead of Benjamin. Benjamin is the one who's guilty, but I will stand in for him. So the person who is surety for another person does whatever is necessary to discharge all obligations of the one for whom surety is given. Now, in the context in Proverbs chapter 6, it might be a simpler case. It might just be a matter of one person taking out a loan. So my friend is trying to get a loan. He's relatively poor. The creditor or the banker is not interested in issuing a loan because he doesn't know if he's ever going to get the loan back from this person. So if I'm standing surety for my friend, it means that I step in and I say, "You go ahead and make the loan, and if he doesn't pay you the loan back, I'll pay it for him." That might be the idea. As I say, we don't have in the Bible, nor do we have in other ancient literature, very many actual cases that would enable us to see in much detail how this sort of thing worked itself out. But the general idea is clear enough. One person is undertaking to guarantee or to back up the obligations of another person. Usually it would be someone who is socially and economically strong who would do this on behalf of someone who is weak in those respects. Now you might wonder, why would anybody do this anyway? Why would anybody step in and offer surety for a stranger? And that's where we're just at a loss. We don't know exactly what would have motivated people to do this kind of thing. Obviously, if I have a close friend or if I have a relative who needs a guarantee of this sort, I would do it in that case. And this paragraph doesn't prohibit the son from stepping in for someone he knows and trusts. But why would you ever become surety for a stranger? That's the situation that's envisaged in verse 1. If you become surety for your neighbor, meaning just some other person, if you have clapped your hands with a stranger. So why would someone do this for a stranger? Well, maybe, we can just surmise, we can just speculate. We're in the gate, the busy gateway of an ancient city where most of the politics are discussed, most of the business is transacted, most of the people tend to congregate, and there's a new person in town, And he doesn't know very many people yet, but he's inquired around a little bit, and he knows that I'm a person of high social standing. And so he approaches me, says, "Hey, I really need this loan to get my business up and flying, and they're not interested in me. I've heard about you that you're a generous person. I've heard about you that you have it all together. So maybe you would step in and offer surety for me." And in an old honor shame based culture, you know, it's kind of flattering to be approached in that sort of way. It enhances my reputation even more that someone who hardly knows me has heard about me and is willing to entrust his cause to me. I don't know. I mean, we're just kind of shooting in the dark here, trying to envisage why somebody would do this. It is, you know, a king addressing his royal sons, warning him about this. But the basic exhortation is, look, if you do that for somebody, understand that although you are the more advantaged person, you're actually placing yourself in the hands of this other. And that's not a safe place to be. So don't go there, is what our author says. He's not saying you shouldn't be a generous person. He's not saying you shouldn't bail out the needy. But be aware that you're placing yourself at the mercy, in effect, in the power of this underling for whom you're taking on this obligation, and you might regret it. So be sure you know the person well enough before you make that kind of a commitment. And any further thoughts or insight on this matter of not becoming surety? There are a number of, about half a dozen verses later on in the book of Proverbs that warn in the same way. Yeah. Well, it's a broad exhortation. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do for your neighbor, do for your fellow human being as you would like other people to do for you. And that's why I say, you know, we don't have in these verses an absolute prohibition. He's not saying never become surety for anyone. But I think our wise author is saying understand human nature and know that if you do become surety for someone, that person could potentially take tremendous advantage of you. And so be aware of that possibility and watch who it is for whom you become surety.
In that sense, even loving your neighbor as yourself, I mean, we're to be spirit-led in the works we do, right?
Yeah, you have to be prudent.
So, I mean, if you're, I guess that's the thing, you have to be spirit-led in
that. And that's the nature of the book of Proverbs. It doesn't necessarily lay out for us all the details or all the rules about how we should apply these principles. It just gives us a principle, and then it leaves us to work out, you know, is this a person I should offer surety for, or is it someone I should back away from? We still have to rely on prudence and on the guiding of the Spirit in that moment to know what to do with this kind of an exhortation. Good point. Anything else arising from the first five verses? Okay, the next few verses, 6 to 11, have to do with an entirely different issue. Here we have just a hodgepodge of topics. So, being a diligent worker, go to the ant, O sluggard, There are a number of proverbs that address the sluggard or that make observations about the sluggard. Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways, and become wise. Without having any chief officer or ruler, she prepares her food in summer and gathers her sustenance in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to nap, and poverty will come upon you like a vagabond, and want like an armed man. I guess our tendency as human beings is to work as little as we can, get as much out of life for as little effort as possible. And there's some wisdom in that. But it can shade over into laziness in the case of certain kinds of temperament. And so verse 8 tells us, like the ant, we should prepare our food in summer. In other words, you know, in an agricultural society, you don't necessarily see the benefits of your labor right away. There are some activities that bring immediate satisfaction, others that offer delayed satisfaction, and going out and plowing your field and sowing your seed is definitely a delayed satisfaction kind of activity. So be like the ant. Look ahead. Be preparing for the future. Do now what you have to do so that there will be a harvest in the autumn. And then when the harvest rolls around, don't be napping, but go out and collect what has grown. By doing that, you ensure your sustenance. I think I quoted earlier, and it might have been more appropriate to quote in this connection than in whatever connection it was, but one word of C.S. Lewis I've always appreciated, one of his graduate students after he died. You know, C.S. Lewis was a don in the University of Oxford, a tutor in Oxford, and he also taught at Cambridge. So he had lots of graduate students who would come to him, and writing an academic thesis is kind of like this long-term delayed satisfaction sort of activity. In other words, you don't get your thesis done overnight. It took me 4 years to write my thesis when I was over there. It's a matter of a daily slog. You're going to the library, you're looking up books, you're making notes, you do it again the next day, you do it again the next day. You write a chapter and submit it, and your supervisor sends it back to you with some suggestions for improvement, so you rewrite the chapter, and it just goes on and on and on and on. I think I'm told that fewer than 25% of those who embark on the DPhil program at Oxford actually write the thesis, actually end up finishing their work. And so C.S. Lewis, being in the position of a mentor, used to tell his graduate students, if you work steadily, you don't have to work hard. Just be at it each day. You don't have to do 10 or 12 hours every day. Just do something every day, and it will get done in the end, and you won't be in the position of having to do all-nighters. So if you work steadily, you don't have to work hard. And that's kind of the exhortation here to the sluggard. The sluggard is not being told, get out there and drive your brow to sweating, 15 hours every day. But the sluggard is told, get off your bottom, and do now what has to be done, to ensure, a prosperous future, because a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to nap, and poverty will come upon you like a vagabond. I love the poetic language here. Any stories, any reflections on this exhortation to the sluggard? Any self-admitted sluggards in the crowd? Okay, that brings us to two sort of general paragraphs, and they're similar to each other. First, we have verses 12 to 15, and then at least in my edition, we have verses 16 to 19, separated by a little space on the page. Let's read 12 to 15 first. A worthless person, a wicked man, goes about with crooked speech. Let's count these characteristics of the wicked person. Characteristic number one is crooked speech. He winks with his eyes. That's number two. He scrapes with his feet. Number three. Number four, points with his finger. Number five, with perverted heart, devises evil. And then number six, continually sowing discord. Therefore, calamity will come upon him suddenly. In a moment, he will be broken beyond healing. So there we have six characteristics of the worthless person, the wicked man. The next little paragraph, verses 16 to 19, we'll take these together because they are comparable in a number of ways. This is one of the so-called numerical proverbs. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven which are an abomination to him. And so we have just about the same number of characteristics. Haughty eyes, number one. Number two, a lying tongue. Number three, hands that shed innocent blood. Number four, a heart that devises wicked plans. Number five, feet that make haste to run to evil. Number six, a false witness who breathes out lies. And number seven, a man who sows discord among brothers. There are other proverbs that use this same kind of numerical introduction. It's just one of the poetic patterns that's used. There's several of these in the book, or in chapter 30, written by Agur, the son of Yakeh of Massa. Chapter 30, in fact, has quite a number of these numerical proverbs. Chapter 30, verse 15. The leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. Three things are never satisfied. Four never say enough. And then we get a list. Sheol, the barren womb, the earth ever thirsty for water, fire that never says enough. Same thing in verse 18. Three things are too wonderful for me. Four I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. How a man romances a maiden. There's a mystery. Apparently. Verse 21, under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up. And on it goes throughout the rest of that chapter. We get these little lists of things. It might have been a device designed sort of to grab the attention, and it's kind of inviting the listener to say, here, I'm going to give you a list of things to remember, see if you can get them all, and then recall them at some later date. In any case, we have six in chapter 6, verses 12 to 15, and then we have one added in the next four verses. Do you see any similarities as we look at verses 12 to 19. Two lists of either six or seven things that describe the wicked person. Anything in common between these paragraphs? Okay, a couple of them are quite closely related, aren't they? Middle of verse 14, middle of the first list, with perverted heart devises evil. Compare that with the first part of verse 18, a heart that devises wicked plans. So in both cases, there's reference to the core, being an evil core, devising wicked thoughts. And then they also, as Becky points out, they also both refer to sowing discord, 14b and 19b. Anything else that these lists have in common, David?
They all use body parts to make points and discourage fellow believers.
Okay, yeah, using the imagery of human anatomy to help us remember these things. So, I guess you could say in verse 12, crooked speech has to do with the mouth, and then it moves up to the eyes, and then down to the feet, and then the finger, even more clearly in the next lot, haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands, a heart, feet. So that's a device that makes these sayings, these lists, memorable. They both include lying, crooked speech in verse 12, a lying tongue in verse 17, also in verse 19, a false witness who breathes out lies. The crooked speech of verse 12 seems to be the one that gets multiplied into two in the next series. Well, let's talk about each one then. Verse 12, worthless person, a wicked man, goes about with crooked speech. Speech that's twisted. Speech that isn't straight. Speech that doesn't tell the truth as it is, but bends it. Now, what's exactly meant in verse 13 by these three actions? Winking with the eyes, scraping with the feet, pointing with the finger. We wish we knew. It would be nice if we could transport ourselves back to ancient Israelite culture and find out what kind of significance these actions would have had. Does winking with the eyes mean sort of giving the go-ahead to someone who wants to undertake an evil action? I'm not going to stop you. I'm going to wink. I'm going to overlook this. Is that the significance of it? The Hebrew word there actually has to do with pressing or squeezing. It's a person who squeezes his eyes, pinches his eyes, is kind of the meaning of the word. So maybe it isn't winking in our sense, but maybe it has more to do with, I don't know, would it tie in with the haughty eyes of verse 17? Would there be a parallel here? Or is it just some kind of a signal? Are we envisaging a person here who's giving some kind of signals to accomplices? So I'll give a wink, I'll do a little shuffle with my foot, or I'll point with my finger. You have an idea, Pat? Thank you. Whoever winks the eye causes trouble. So it's saying, I suppose, in effect, maybe it is that first idea then. You know, maybe I'm not the one doing the trouble, but if I give the go-ahead to somebody who is, if I just give that person a wink, saying we'll overlook this, then I become just as responsible as the actual perpetrator is. That's helpful to see how winking is used in another passage elsewhere in the same book. So here's another idea. Yeah, maybe it's just describing a person who isn't fully straightforward. As far as the next characteristic is concerned, the middle of verse 13, we really are almost totally at a loss. RSV says scrapes with his feet. Any other translations out there? Shuffles with his feet. Signals with his feet. They're taking it as a signal of some sort. Hebrew word there, malal, is found only once, only here in the whole Hebrew Bible. And it's a word that doesn't seem to be related etymologically to any others. It sounds like some other words, especially the word mole, but the meaning doesn't fit here. And so, in desperation, those who make Hebrew lexicons have gone to late rabbinic Hebrew, and they've come up with this idea of scraping. But whether that's what it meant over 1,000 years before, when Solomon wrote the word, we can't really be confident. You know, it happens more often in the Old Testament than it does in the New. There aren't very many words in the Greek New Testament that occur only once in all known literature. Those words are called a hapax legomenon, spoken once. And those are the mysterious words. Normally, to determine what a word means, someone who's making a dictionary will find as many occurrences of it as necessary, actual contexts, and just plug in different meanings until you find the meaning that seems to work in all those places. But if you don't have any more than one context where a word exists, then you're just left to guesswork as to what the word means. So here we're at something of a loss. It could be a signal. I have wondered whether it might have any connection at all with it. They say that throughout Arabic culture, to show the sole of your foot to somebody is a tremendous insult to that person. It's as if you're kind of trampling them under your foot or something like that to show your soul. So, if you ever find yourself sitting in a room with a bunch of Arabs, whatever you do, don't cross your ankle over your knee and show your soul to anybody. It gives grave offense. And I've wondered whether this could have something to do with that. This is the person who winks with his eyes, who insults someone with his foot. But that's just pure guess. I have no etymological basis for it at all. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, likewise, the pointing with the finger, you know, is this just some kind of a previously agreed signal between the shifty person and his associates, or should we put these two lists together and look down below and see that in verse 19, a false witness breathes out lies? You know, that could be a pointing of the finger, trying to shift blame onto someone else. So once in a while, we face uncertainties. Yeah. So maybe this could be some kind of insulting behavior too. Maybe that would provide 5% support for my speculation about blanking with the feet, whatever that blanking is, malaling with the feet. Well, perverted heart devises evil. That's clear enough. And there comes to mind one of the later Proverbs. Now the question is, can we find it in the heat of the moment? Yes, Proverbs 24, verses 8 and 9. Fills in this idea a little bit. He who plans to do evil will be called a mischief maker. The devising of folly is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to men. And I think what those verses are saying is, it's not just the commission of evil, not just the carrying of an idea into reality, but the very idea itself in the heart, if it's a sinful idea, makes a person a full-blown mischief maker, sinner, and scoffer. Pointing out that, you know, what we do always flows from what we think. And so sin begins in the heart. Sin begins in the devising of evil plans, even before we act on those plans. And we find that kind of language both in verse 14 of chapter 6. Here's a person with a perverted heart who devises evil. Likewise, in verse 18, a heart that devises wicked plans. Well, as we move down into the next set of seven things, these are a little bit more straightforward. Haughty eyes, pride, arrogance, looking down on others, inappropriately exalting the self. The lying tongue doesn't require a lot of comment. Hands that shed innocent blood. There's the heart that devises wicked plans. Feet that make haste to run to evil. A false witness breathing out lies. And they both mention sowing discord among brothers. The human being who makes trouble by sowing untruths, destroying reputations, staking false claims, and stirring up turmoil. So, there we have the worthless person. I guess it's worth a look at the worthless person. Want to be a worthless person? Do these things. If you don't want to be a worthless person, do the opposite. And so we come to verse 20. My son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. Bind them upon your heart always. Tie them about your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. When you awake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. So here's another of these motivational sections. Maybe just a comment about verse 23. You know, Jesus said, "I am the light of the world." But when Jesus made that claim, he lived in Palestine. He was addressing Jewish people, and they probably would have had this kind of imagery at the back of their minds. In the Old Testament, where Jesus Christ has not yet come as a person, has not yet become incarnate, what they had from God was His Torah, the body of His commandments given to Israel as the expression of His grace in that time and in that covenantal framework. And so here, not Jesus Christ, but God's commandment is a lamp. God's teaching is a light. So when Jesus Christ did become incarnate, He made flesh everything that's included in a verse like this. He was the embodiment of God's commandments and of God's teaching. He was the human being who did it all as it ought to be done. And so He fulfilled in that way all the principles of Torah and made provision that all of us who are in union with Him will be like Him in that respect. We too will be those who walk by this lamp and enjoy the light of this teaching. He also claimed to be the way, the truth, and the life. And here we're told that the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. So a verse like this stands in direct continuity with the coming of Jesus at a further point on in time. Well, there we have the first 23 verses of Proverbs chapter 6. Any parting comments about these verses? Yeah.
Going back to verse 16, when it says better than our abominations to Him, why does He list just these ones, but there's obviously others in the Bible that are considered an abomination?
Why these things are chosen? Okay, there's the question. Why are these seven characteristics chosen as an abomination? I don't think the author means to say these are the only seven things that are an abomination, but he's just saying, here I've got a handful of things for you to remember. Six of them, actually, it's seven. So tuck them away. Try to avoid being this kind of a person. But I don't think he's making a claim that this is the exhaustive list of all the things that would be abominable to God. Yeah? Well, we did read over quickly the remaining verses in this chapter last week. Maybe we'll just hit them once more. I don't have a great deal to add myself, but somebody else might want to chip in on verses 24 to 35. So let's read them, and then we'll pause to take up any issues that might arise. So the commandment is a lamp, the teaching is a light, the reproofs of discipline are the way of life, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adventuress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart. Do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. That verse, of course, is very similar to Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 of Matthew, verse 28. I say to you that everyone who looks at everyone who gazes on a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So don't even desire her beauty. We did comment last week on verse 26. Probably the best translation would be something like this. For the exchange of a harlot is a loaf of bread, but an adulteress stalks a man's very life. Go to a harlot, you lose a day's eating. That's costly enough, but stop and think before you go to a man's wife, because she's stalking your whole life and not just a day's worth of bread. Can a man carry fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk upon hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes in to his neighbor's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. And then the rest of the chapter focuses on the economic consequences of adultery. Do not people despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his appetite when he's hungry? He has better reason to steal than you have to go to an adulteress. And if he is caught, he will pay sevenfold. He will give all the goods of his house. He who commits adultery has no sense. He who does it destroys himself. Wounds and dishonor will he get. His disgrace will not be wiped away, for jealousy makes a man furious. Her husband will find out. He'll take you to court. He'll impose a fine on you that will be a lifelong burden. And he will not spare when he takes revenge. He will accept no compensation nor be appeased, though you multiply gifts. Maybe they lived in a more moral society than we do.
What's the question I was going to ask? Do you know any modern-day society where this kind of discipline would be sanctioned?
This kind of social sanction on that behavior, yeah.
It doesn't seem very prevalent that there's much more than a wrist slap for these things
in our society. Mm-hmm. A wrist slap from those who are moral and mean, and cheers from others. Yeah. How far have we fallen? Yeah. That can happen. Mm-hmm. Out comes the gun. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the point he's making. Jealousy will accept nothing in return for this kind of an offense. Becomes a lifelong burden. Mm-hmm. Well, good. That leaves us. Now, Terry Preheim just got up and left. I think we have, today is the first. I think we have 3 Sundays left, do we, in this series? Until the 22nd of May, I believe. So 3 chapters, 3 weeks, working out okay.